and then make sure you're recording on your end, and then we'll go,
yeah,
you know, whatever. We'll figure it out. We'll figure
we're
it
live.
Out.
Well, recording, not live.
It's not the same thing. You're right. Fair yeah. enough. Fair point.
We'll edit that in post.
Are any of us really live?
Oh, shit. That's the real question.
When we said deep dive, what we really meant was existential crisis time.
Oh, my God. I went on a huge, like, you know when you just sort of get on something and you're like, okay, we're going somewhere with this. I was talking about dimensions and angels and demons and, like, the perception of reality and stuff with my brother the other day. Shit got whack.
Ooh.
But sometimes you just got to.
Sometimes you just need to make those goofy little, like, stoner dives, as I'd like to call them.
Yes.
Where you're just like, but can I prove that I exist?
Right. I think, therefore I am, but what does that mean? You know? Speaking of goofy little side quest I always like to take is watching a good old film from my childhood, The Road to El Dorado, Patty. Classic 2000s DreamWorks film.
Actually, I'm pretty sure it is just 2000. We can't even say 2000, it is just 2000.
Yeah, I was looking to see if I could find some other movies that came out in 2000, so I looked up 2000s movies, and I'm like, oh wait. That is a whole decade now of stuff.
Which is freaky to think about.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I saw something where someone posted something about, like, oh, I went to the liquor store and showed the ID, and then the guy's like, nah, you don't need to take it out. I saw the one. Because now everyone who, like, if your birth date, the year, starts with a one, you're at least 21 years old. Like, that's just a hard, fast rule now.
Oh, my God.
So that's when they said, I saw the one, that meant that you were born in the 20th century, and now everyone born in that century can drink, which is a little terrifying.
That's whack. That's super whack. So. Wow. It's crazy how time passes, and things change, but some things stay the same. Like my love for this movie. Classic film, Road to El Dorado, 2000 DreamWorks film.
This is actually just an hour-long ad for The Road to El Dorado and DreamWorks.
Yeah. Please hire me, DreamWorks.
I can't say that I... So, like, this is an interesting movie because I know I watched it as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't say I remember, like, super specific things. Like, I always knew. I was like, oh, that's Road to El Dorado. But, like, I couldn't remember, like, a lot of what happened in the movie until we, like, recently watched it for this. Which is interesting. And then also when I was rewatching it obsessively, I realized I think I'm one of the weird kids who's, you know, everyone's like, oh, I really connected and I love with this Disney movie or something. It's like, I honestly, like, remember most of the movies that I watched, I feel like almost weren't Disney. And I think that the DreamWorks intro sequence, like, sticks in my brain a lot more.
Yeah.
I don't know if that just means I was, like, raised a little bit more, like, as a living, breathing meme or what. But, like, I had that kind of...
No, that checks out.
Profound, like, experience being like, oh, like... Because I remember, to be honest, I could recall a lot more details from the movie Ants than A Bug's Life.
Hey.
And then I think I just need to rewatch some of these movies because I feel like they hit with a lot more kind of mature content, to be totally honest.
Well, yeah, I think it's like, oh, adult humor or whatever. But I think, like, when you grow older and you start watching, like, cartoons and things you used to watch as a kid, your brain just sort of, like, makes sense of things a little differently. Mm-hmm. And you're like, oh, that's why that's, like clever or like heartbreaking or like whatever it is, like your brain just sort of comprehends that a little bit more straightforward. And that's why I think it's fun to go back and rewatch, things you watched as a kid and just be like, oh, okay, I get it.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I guess especially getting into that new adult kind of filter, I'd say, you look at certain like kids films and stuff like that you watched or that is coming out now and you're just like, "Oh wow, that's heavy or that's super violent or something." Or like that's a lot more than I anticipated. I wasn't expecting that, you know, in something marketed to kids like. But then you realize that you missed that when you were a kid. It
Right?
went straight over your head.
Didn't even notice.
Which is, yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it's just, I think, like when we were talking to Sarah, like, if you can appeal to a broader audience, something that lasts, like, that's just means you're telling the story right, telling it
Yeah.
well.
And even to emphasize on some of the points that you, because it's just like interesting, especially talking about cartoons and thinking about what Sarah had to say, like just using just normal language. Obviously this was an animated film, like just to bring it back to the film we've been obsessively watching for a week. It's like, but it's not like kiddie language or like dum-dum talk. It's just dialogue, people talking, story being told. And I think the dialogue is something that's like really interesting to me in this film, is that like it's just like good banter, you know? Like Miguel and Tulio just sort of have this dynamic that I'm just like obsessed with, like the red and the blue, right? Who's your red, who's your blue? Today we have Miguel and Tulio. And I learned that this is pretty unusual for like any voice actor would know. You usually record your lines like in your own sort of booth, right? You do your own thing. But for Miguel and Tulio, at least for some scenes, especially the sword fight when they're in Spain, they were in the same room together, which apparently like the audio crew was not happy about. But it gave a lot of character to their dialogue, and they're sort of stepping on each other, talking like I don't know. I just think it has a lot of just life to it that I really appreciate in this movie.
Yeah, I noticed that too, and I think it was so Tulio was voiced by Kevin Kline and Miguel was voiced by Kenneth, oh God, Branagh. But there was a quote that they had, and it was like they apparently just had like electric chemistry, and it was like nothing you ever seen before. And one of them quoted like, "Yeah," and it worked because we just got to sit in there and talk, and together we make one half-wit. Which was, I thought was, you know, pretty spot on for the
Yeah,
type of characters
beautiful.
that Miguel and Tulio are. And so I think that really added to it. And you could definitely tell, and you can easily tell when like the chemistry is off, even in like voice acting and stuff.
No, they were a dynamic duo. Miguel and Tulio share a brain cell, and
Just one.
that's just one between the two of them. And then they gave it to Shell. Yeah.
Yep.
Shell. Oh my God, I can't believe I fucked. We'll edit that in post. Ugh. But no, I love good dialogue. That's like, I'm not gonna go on a whole tangent, but that's part of the reason I love like Dragon Age games so much. Is that there's just great party banter the whole time, wandering around Thedas, just having your party say some funny shit.
Yeah, it just
But.
makes the characters seem real. Like feel like actual people. And so that was also one thing like with this movie too, I'm trying to also remember what I remember about learning about Cortez. I don't think I remembered I was taught anything good other than that he kind of ran through South America. I know I didn't learn about all the atrocities that he committed. But I'm also happy that, especially in the past like 20 years since this movie came out, his character is kind of just this shitty human being comes across super clear, and it was super clear back then too. Because like given this movie with its it does have like this huge hint of white saviorism with Miguel and Tulio going in
Oh,
and
sure.
like saving everything, but aside from like I mean there's other issues and stuff, but I'm just glad that they got things like that right, especially because I feel like early 2000s was kind of when I feel like, at least this is just from my personal perspective, from, going through school, when the idea of like anti-Columbus Day kind of stuff sentiment was like really starting to gain a lot of ground and traction. So it's interesting 'cause, oh, actually, now that I'm thinking about it, I'm interested to know when The Emperor's New Groove came out, because I also know that
I
DreamWorks
think
and
the
Disney
same
had.
year.
Ooh.
Or like
Interesting.
really close.
Yeah. I find it fascinating how different studios like that will almost release two movies that are almost exactly the same, whether it's like plot-wise, idea-wise, or setting-wise. Because I feel like that happens with a lot of movies. Like, for one that I can think of off the top of my head was the two movies No Strings Attached and Friends with Benefits, I'm pretty sure. Basically, like, the exact same movie, exact same idea, and then pretty sure they came out in the same year. And it's just
Whack.
odd to me if that's, I don't know if it's just studios playing off of trends and everything, but it's weird how we get stuck into those kind of, almost cycles and patterns.
Yeah.
So I'm
Ooh, now I'm thinking
wondering,
hard about that.
yeah,
Ooh.
'cause I'm wondering like what might have led to that, 'cause I mean the only thing I can think of culturally in that time with America is an interest in South America after the World Cup was hosted in the US and Brazil won in the 90s. That's the closest thing that I can think of. Like, I'm not sure what drives those kind of like, America like freaking out about like, oh, this is the cool new kind of cultural trend to get into. At least, I don't know, maybe I'm just like completely wrong in saying that, but like, I don't know, it's weird to me how we can have those like identical things, and I'm sure there's a reason.
Yeah. I
It's
mean,
just kind of
yeah, I
odd.
was trying to see if I could dig it up 'cause I don't have any information either. It is really curious, like how do these things like co like is it coincidence? Sometimes. But yeah, the at least in my sparse research, I'm sure people know a lot more about this movie than we do. But they just wanted something like really different from The Prince of Egypt, which was the film that came out right before this from DreamWorks. Which lots of tech stuff there that like whatever led the way for El Dorado, but it just mostly just for a change of pace, it makes me want to think. I mean, sure there had to like why this particularly? It makes you think too, because now oh, Patty, you got me thinking about all sorts of stuff. Because while I was doing my research for 2000s animated films, like I saw some nondescript, like weird CGI, like Sinbad thing come up, and then like a few years later, DreamWorks releases Sinbad, another fabulous movie, by DreamWorks. But it just makes you wonder, like, are we all drinking the same Kool-Aid? Whack.
Yeah, I'm not sure. And I mean, I think it also lends itself to, now it doesn't exactly explain why these movies would come out in the same year, which means they went into production at the same time, and then it's a question of whether or not each studio knew about the other's project. But it definitely would make sense if like, oh, like what you just said, oh, there was this lower budget movie that came out one year about Sinbad, and then DreamWorks released it another one shortly after. That could just be a matter of inspiration, kind of like, oh, I like that idea, because that's something that personally, like, I stumble with, and I've had one of my friends tell me that, it's like I will sit there and obsess over like, oh, this chord progression is too close to this song, so it's technically like bordering on plagiarism. And it's like, no, like the thing is that you can be inspired by other pieces and stuff, and you can almost like take bits of that and pay homage to them to an extent, just as long as you're not just like, so like for a song, for instance, like you can use other songs' chord progressions. Nobody can patent a chord progression, like that's just out in the air. But if you have that chord progression at the same time, BPM in relation to a melody that's exactly the same, then you get into,
Yeah.
trouble there. So, but
Gets a little
it's
dicey.
yeah, but like you can sit there and be like, oh, I like how that chord progression goes. And then you can use that chord progression because it's inspiring. You're like, oh, I want to write something else on top of it. And so that's one thing is like, I will get stuck up on like, oh, I just rewrote this song, when it's like, Yeah, there's some similarities, but the thing is you can look at anything and you'll find a lot of similarities. Now, I'm not saying you should go out and like, so say for instance, you're writing a song and you're like, "Oh, I really like the song, say, Out Singing by Gestalt." Just to shout out my good old boys that I love. And you're like, "Oh, I like the song." And then if you just go home and like basically rewrite the song but change the lyrics, that's not okay. But if you like the way the chord progression goes, and then you can kind of add your own guitar melody or vocal melody on top of that, that's another story. That's you creating still. It's not you ripping something, which I'd imagine you might have something kind of similar with that, with illustrating and stuff, right? Because I mean, essentially, that's from my understanding, that's kind of how, you know, in my music world, it's kind of what music theory is. It's like, oh, there's all these sounds, they fit together this way. People figured out this person did this and it fits together this way. You can do that, or you can do it this way. And I'd imagine the same thing is, you know, carries along with like almost techniques and
Yeah.
approaches.
There's definitely like little things that like an artist will do, like and then you'll start seeing other people sort of do that thing. Not usually it's not usually a copy like stroke for stroke style plagiarism, but obviously that happens all over the place. But things like using lines to accent this in that way, or like filling or like using something that everybody got really into was using like white ink dots on stuff, which started somewhere, and then everyone's like, well, now everyone just does it, which is kind of how art trends evolve, at least in my circle, which is kind of interesting. But
Yeah. And I mean, I'd imagine it works the same thing for like movies. So basically, like, oh, someone uncovers like this, you know, story or this idea for a story, and then they express it, and someone's like, I like that idea. Now let me try my version type of thing. But I think it gets wonky when you get to, you know, what we were talking about, you know, initially was you have these side by side with like identical settings or identical plots coming out from two separate sources at the same time. And like in a, you know, a larger population, you know, that'd just be a coincidence. It wouldn't be that big of a deal. Like, but n the entire population, each person is not individually making a movie. Like, there's only so many big movie studios out there like that.
Yeah, that's a good
So
point.
that's what gets weird, is that here's my number nerd coming out, but like statistically, it's pretty improbable that there was not some type of flow of information, whether it was willing or not, between those two studios. Like it, there was probably something going on where someone caught wind of something, and that's where you get some more competition breeding, which would make sense, but it's still kind of odd to me. I don't know. But at the same time, people can in fact come up with almost the exact same idea halfway across the world at the same time, and no one's plagiarizing. Like, I don't know if there is a squirrel up this tree that we're barking.
Oh, yeah. Okay, I was hunting for just something in this article that I was reading about the film. Damn, they posted this at midnight. Respect. Yeah, like there's no tangible evidence for what why specifically El Dorado, 'cause like it's like what could be more like for the setting, what could be newer or more exciting, or sorry, is this plagiarism from the New World? Sorry, 16th century. This lush, pristine paradise lent itself ideally to the artistry of the animation team at DreamWorks. Obviously, it's beautiful. So like hell, maybe everyone did just want to start painting jungles. That's what everybody was into. Like, did Tarzan come out like around the same time? And everyone's just like, ooh, jungles. Like, makes you wonder.
I'm not sure. Well, so Tarzan also just takes place not in South America.
Oh
So
no, yeah, sorry. I'm thinking about just jungles.
yeah, maybe, I'm not sure. So like from here it says that the screenwriters actually got a copy of Hugh Thomas's book Conquest Montezuma, Cortez and the Fall of Old Mexico. So basically, they were like, oh, we want to make a movie on this, what's called the Age of Discovery.
Okay.
And so from there, they kind of come up with movie ideas. And so from what this says here, they were inspired by Bob Hope and Bing Crosby's Road to dot 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 films, which were kind of, as Wikipedia describes here, films with self-interested comedic anti-heroes who would set out to find the lost city of gold after acquiring a map to its location. So that was kind of, so they have, there we have like, oh, I was inspired by like this book because I'm interested in this time area, which, you know, all it takes is someone like, you know, you stumble upon things. Like, we dive down rabbit holes. Like, look at us right now. We were just like, we want to make an episode because we're a little bit nervous about not having enough guests to carry us through. And then
You want
we,
to be on our
like,
show? No, I'm just kidding.
yeah. Please email us. And so we're like, oh, this is a, it's an entertaining piece of art. It's a piece of work. We can kind of dive into it from a whole bunch of different angles. And somehow it's kind of resurfaced like in a big way as a whole bunch of memes, as it's provided a ton of meme formats.
Very memeable.
And it's been pretty big in the D&D circles because essentially this story is literally, you can describe it as a bard and a rogue set out on an adventure, and the DM has only allowed them to play with an all or nothing coin. So if you listeners do not play Dungeons and Dragons, an all or
You
nothing
should.
coin, you should, A, but an all or nothing coin kind of means that, so if you're trying to do something, you'll typically roll a d20. So that means you have a 5% chance of getting any number, with 20 being the best outcome, 1 being the worst outcome. So a 20 is called a crit success or a critical hit, while 1 is a crit fail. So basically, if you roll one of those two numbers, like it doesn't matter what modifiers or, you know, other numbers you can add onto it, you fail or you succeed if you roll that number. Whereas if you roll like a 16, you may or may not fail to a certain extent, but like if a critical success happens, my rule as the DM is like, oh, so you get to decide what happens. Like, this, you set out to do exactly what you wanted to do. So what happens? Describe it to me. Whereas a critical fail, I'll be like, okay, so you messed up horribly. Let
Yeah,
me see
real
how I can
bad.
make this entertaining. And so essentially, an all or nothing coin means you roll a 20 or a 1 and no numbers in between. Which you can see, I think, it just, this story just plays out exactly like that, where you see, like when they are in the brig on the ship and they're trying to get the crowbar or get Altivo the horse to get them the crowbar, I would say, so it would be like a crit success to lure him over with the apple and then to convince him to go try and find a crowbar. But then it was a crit fail that Altivo did not find a crowbar, but then the DM totally messed up and probably rolled a crit fail on his side. So flipped and got a one, and that's how they ended up with the keys. Like, it's just those like wild things, because it's basically like, oh, you get everything that goes, that's super, you know, it's super unreasonable that this will go your way, but then it just does. And then, oh, you're gonna try something and then it just goes horribly wrong and you still have to deal with it,
Oh, yeah.
which, you know, ultimately makes a good story because you have to have all of those issues. You have to have there's a better word for this. Conflicts. You have to have these conflicts and like these uncomfortable situations that you're thrust into, and you can see how your characters make it out.
Yeah. Which is part of the reason that I love this movie so much is that, like, I mean, like, all movies, like, you know, you're like out of the frying pan into the fire. Like, this happens a lot for these two. You know, like turn by turn, you're like, aha, success, and then they're like, oh fuck, we're found out. Like, ah, success, you know? But
Yes.
I love that you're comparing it to Dungeons and Dragons, because there's like definitely like there's two or three scenes that like really stick out for me in that regard. It's like, okay, so they're sneaking off the boat, right? They're rowing down the thing, and like Altivo wants his fucking apple. So Tulio
Yes.
grabs it and he's like, okay, I'm just gonna throw the apple up to the horse, right? Like, simple course
Yes.
of action. And then it misses the horse, bounces all around the freaking ship, and then lands into the ocean. Cue Altivo also jumping off the boat. Crit fail. And then, like, that. scene where they're about to do that like reverent sacrifice at dawn and stuff, and Tulio's, you know, the stars can't do it, not today. Like classic meme. Intimidation check, like can't do it today. And then Zekle Khan's like, oh yeah, okay, you know, like convincing that bitch that like he was
Yeah.
wrong.
That's
Quack.
even like a straight D&D interaction too, where it's just like the DM's like, there's no way you're gonna intimidate him, and then they do, and you're just like, oh, well, shit.
Yeah, not 20,
Yeah,
bitch.
I guess you're right.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, and I think it's also, it adds a little bit to the enjoyment and kind of just consumption of the story too, where you can kind of imagine it unfolding as opposed to just like being told to you. And I think that's one of the magic things about this movie is that it got that nice little like tie into D&D, and it like blew up in the D&D community, was just that like, oh yeah, you're right, it is just a bard and a rogue running around pulling shit. 'Cause then it, I think it just adds an aspect, 'cause you can, I feel like it takes something else to fully like be immersed in a story and feel like you are truthfully experiencing it and connecting with the characters. And so I think that while this one, it definitely doesn't get to the depth of like connecting with them, which again, like we talked with Sarah a couple weeks ago, and she was saying her argument is that television is the best medium for storytelling because you invite these people into your homes and you know they're there, you get to know these characters on their downtimes, whereas a movie you get an hour to 3 hours or so to tell a story, get to know these characters, do some character development, and especially with this being primarily a comedy, the emotions and the like the character depth isn't as important. But I think one thing that's nice about this movie is that the characters themselves feel very alive, very real, and we don't need to go into that extra depth. We don't need to learn about what happened in Barcelona. We, you know, we're able to take these two characters at face value, and they are delivered with such confidence and chemistry that, you know, it ultimately, like it works out in the long run and creates for an entertaining piece of tomfoolery.
Yeah, and it's like we're comfortable being on the ride with them for this length of time, you know. It's like I'm down for this. And mind you know I'm a lore loving bitch, so I'm like, I want to know what happened in Barcelona. I want to know what Chell's deal is. Like, can we just talk about like how she's like, I'm gonna like get in on the con with you guys because I need to get the fuck out of here, you know? You've got your reasons, I've got mine. What are those reasons, Chell? Who hurt you? You
Yes.
know, I'm just wondering, like, but that's neither here nor there.
And I think it was also, it's set up that the story can continue. And I think
Yeah,
that's
it.
something that I like too, is that, and so again, like part of the idea of like creating this podcast, I swear I was inspired by something Sarah said in one of her videos to bring her up for the 100th time this episode, where I swear she said something and she had a line about, oh, and that's the nice thing about a story is that once the story's done being told, like on screen or in the book, it doesn't mean that the story ends for us, and then we continue the story on afterwards, whether it be part of our own story. And I just love that idea, and I feel like that's something that, you know, I guess like as corny as riding off into the sunset kind of seems, it's also just a very fitting way to end any story,
Oh, yeah.
because then it just leaves it open, and it's like, you know, here, we've given you a quick crash course on this story, these characters. What do you think happens next? And it just begs for further, you know, creativeness, which I can really appreciate. There was
Yeah.
definitely a time in my life where I was like, oh, this song fades out, that's so corny, or they just didn't know how to end the song. And then I was like, you know, fade out's a fucking good ending, and it takes a lot of technical knowledge to pull it off right. So it's not corny, and it's actually like really cool. And it, not everything has to have a clean end like in a song. Like, You can fade out. That's cool.
Yeah. Sometimes you can just ride it out into the sunset.
Exactly.
Although, fun fact, this movie was supposed to have multiple sequels, apparently, and then it totally tanked at the box office, so they were like, we're not going to do that. But rip to what could have been. But to be honest, part of me kind of like appreciates that it's like, it's just the road to El Dorado, you know? Mm-hmm. We don't have to suffer through like two or three or four like modifications and then just see the characters deteriorate into just like money grab, you know? Because that tends to happen.
Yes. Yes. I think that's also an interesting thing to dive into. Because, like, I feel like sequels are a hot topic, especially when you get into any kind of forum about anything.
Yeah.
Especially, like, when you go, well, so, like, it's, and it's definitely different if you go into things, you know, if they set out to make one movie with no intention of making other ones, like, just a standalone. And then, like, oh, we're going to make a sequel to this story. Mm. And then, it, you know, people are like, oh, it always tanks. It's always worse. It gets ruined and stuff. Which, you know, isn't always true. But I can understand the sentiment. And so I'm interested. So, like, once you get out into that, like, the sequel territory, do you think that there's a level of creativeness that's lost or that it's, you know, the entire venture and story is lost entirely to kind of capitalistic pursuits of like just a money grab? Because I think that there's a few sides to this coin that are interesting, because you have, you know, these basically the straight to DVD movies, like, let's say, you know, any of like the, I guess, what, Disney Princess, like sequel movies for the most part. Like, oh, yeah. In, like, the early 2000s and the 90s and stuff. But then I feel like they had, like, this huge, like, just cult, like, following of, like, young kids that were just like, no, the sequel's better kind of thing. But then, like, when you watch it, it's just two completely different. You can tell the budget wasn't all there for, like, the sequels kind of thing.
Oh, yeah.
But at the same time, like, I think that those kind of movies are important because that's how some people get their break in the creative world and the animation world and the voice acting and whatnot.
Because it's a gig.
Yeah, exactly. It's a gig that has, you know, some potentially high payoffs. And that also kind of brings me back to the idea of, like, I don't know if you remember the Disney Channel, like, movies. Do you remember those ones?
Oh, yes.
Like, well, those,
some of them.
Those are straight up the definition of the modern B-rate film. And it's interesting. Because some of them turn into something. You never know.
Mm-hmm.
Like, some of them, like, explode. Like, for instance, I think a sequel that I'm not sure was intended to be made, but I'll say it. I love every single Toy Story movie. And, like, it blows my mind that Toy Story 2 was, like, a straight-to-DVD movie. But it still pulled its Pixar magic and just kicks you in the face till you cry real hard about abandonment issues, because wow.
Yeah.
So it's just, it's fascinating. Maybe that should be another deep dive, is just that movie.
Yeah, I was about to go into it, but I'm like, this isn't a Toy Story episode, but it could be.
Yeah, because there's just a lot to be gained and lost from making a sequel or not making a sequel. And I think that a lot of people don't give it the benefit of the doubt that it truthfully is just a 50-50 gamble.
Yeah.
If you're not pre-planning to make sequels.
Yeah. Because it's like, the thing, like, I'm thinking about sequels now, right? And it's like you're, like a house flipper, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's this house that's built, right? Everything's in there. You know, you've got your foundation, you've got your characters, you've got your, like, stuff. And then you can take this and do whatever you want with it, like, more or less. And I think that's definitely a 50-50 coin. Like, it could go really well. It's like, oh, I already have this stuff, so it's just, like, free adventure. Or it's like, I already have this stuff, so what do I even do with it? Like, I guess I'll try something. And something I see a lot of, like, no hate to people who have, like, you know, families and kids out there, but, like, like it's always interesting to me when that's the route like people decide to take with sequels. It's like, okay, now they're together and it's like, and now there's, I don't know. I guess I'm just like in an adventure loving bitch that I'm just like, okay, let's have another Monster of the Week, you know? But I know sequels are interesting.
They're interesting, yeah, because I think case in point, with it being a cash grab, and it's also just our attention's hooked. Like, if someone made a sequel, you're gonna go check it out. Because in my research, I found this thing. It was like an idea page where someone actually kind of wrote out like a dream casting and like an idea of what the story would be, like a full on like plot synopsis of what The Road to El Dorado 2 would be, and I got kind of excited because the date the it was made was in 2020. I was like, oh no way, they didn't just make this and just like quietly release it. Like there's no, and there wasn't a way. It does not exist. It was just like a someone on the internet made a story plot. But I was like, just in that excitement, I would have paid to see that movie.
Oh,
And I
yeah.
think that kind of, speaks for itself with sequels, is that if a story or something, catches our attention and essentially catches us the first time, we want to see where it keeps going. Because we have ideas, and I think it's also part of we create our theories, and then we want to see if they line up and if they, match what we receive from the story. And I think that's one thing. I guess saying that idea out loud kind of made me think that maybe that's why a lot of people have issues with sequels, because you'll see, one story and then be like, oh, I got this from that. This character would be like this or that, and then someone else would get something completely different, and then you have a sequel, and maybe it doesn't agree with either, or agrees with one or the other person, but either way, it doesn't line up with someone. And so there you get a point of conflict. And so I think that's one thing that kind of it feels like it people will be like, oh, it betrays this character, or, oh, it betrays this idea, and it's like, not really. Like, sorry to say it, but like you didn't create that character. Like you, and I mean, it speaks that you're feeling so harshly about this character and what they would do, but like it's a
But it's canon,
it's
so.
canon, so uh-oh.
Yeah. Well, that's a really interesting perspective that, like, yeah, you talk about people's interpretation of characters and character development and their reaction when that doesn't, like, stay up. You know? It's really interesting. I could
Yeah.
go, like, I know. No, it's just interesting, I think. Because people will, like, literally, like, take characters from a thing and sort of, like, imagine them to a point that they're not really the original thing anymore, which is kind of interesting. I have a lot of respect for people who just do their thing with that. Like, make as much fan fiction as you fucking want. I don't care. But I don't know, it's just kind of curious, especially when it ends up leading into people's reactions to getting sequels or to getting like more content that doesn't agree with these headcanons that they've made for this character or these characters.
Yeah, the idea of the sequel is kind of interesting because it's all just a play on expectations and meeting, exceeding, or failing those, which ultimately is, what we all face whenever we create anything in our craft. So, like, we'll set expectations. Other people may not have expectations for what we're going to create, or they will, and then they'll live up to them or they won't. And so that's just, it's all a risk, and it, kind of plays back to or feeling of shame, and it's a hard one to, unfortunately, it's a really hard one to work with sometimes.
Oh yeah. Wow, Road to El Dorado, you guys. What what a classic 2000 DreamWorks film.
But earlier you were meant talking about the backgrounds and like the
Oh.
scenescapes, I think.
Yes. Oh my gosh. This movie is so fucking beautiful to me. I don't know why I just censored myself. This movie is so fucking beautiful to me. 'Cause it's just like, I don't know, you so you and you know, you start in Spain, right? And it's all buildings, and there's not really any foliage. There's not a lot of green. It's just buildings and stuff. And then you go onto the ocean, and then you're like on the ocean, and it's scary. And then you have those beautiful scenes of them sort of rowing aimlessly in this turquoise ocean with just Altivo just sitting in the seat. Until we finally get to, like, you know, to the new world, to.
I believe technically is Colombia. At least that's where.
I love how that's like not referenced anywhere.
No, that's part of the whole. That's what I did research on.
Oh, I see. Okay. To this fantasy Columbia, that I don't know when I have a much deeper appreciation for like foliage painting after I did my children's book, which was a lot of foliage painting, which you know I learned to do. That I just like I got so obsessed with the atmosphere and the like the particularly the way they use blue when they paint foliage or like create atmosphere, especially in the jungle. If you rewatch that movie, just pay attention for that. You'll see it. It's fucking gorgeous. I don't know. I just the use of blue and green can create so much dimension and like I'm saying atmosphere and whatever. I don't know. It's just very pretty. And to the point, like the whole scene of them of the Trail We Blaze musical number. Thank you, Elton John and company. I don't know. I like tear up sometimes just because like the scenes are so beautiful and it's animated so nicely and like the song is just sort of gets you, you know? Like they like they're going on the adventure and there's like that sort of monstery looking tunnel and these pink butterflies fly out of it and it's a sunset and I just get all emotional and I'm like, oh boy. But the interesting thing about like these backgrounds, and I want to like keep talking about how, I don't know, they just use color in a really like awesome way in this movie. Like when they stumble into like the big rock that they're like, oh, this is El Dorado, and it's like it's all gray and it's all like scary. And then they go through the tunnel river and it's dark and scary, and then bam, golds and reds and color and sunlight, and it's just like this is fucking El Dorado, and I just And you see like these cool like Technicolor like wildlife, and it's just like it's just such a fucking cool movie like visually, like even all the other stuff that I love about it, even all the like voice acting and the character interactions aside, like I go gaga over like pretty things. I just think it's great, especially like the whole party scene, the like festival where they all get super turnt. Love that.
Had
That is
some
a
it was like that scene from Dumbo, but not traumatizing,
Yeah. Yeah, it got a
which
little
is
spooky at the end, but that's when you start
yes.
bad tripping, you know?
Yeah.
Like that's when you know you've had too much.
Just
Uh-oh.
some drugs in kids' movies.
Drugs and kids movies, like obviously the moment they lit up those, obviously they were intending to be like local cigars, but my brother and I looked at each other like those are some fat blunts, you know? And then literally after they started smoking that, everything started getting really trippy in the scene, so we were just like, yep, confirmed. That's it. But the interesting what I was gonna go off on a tangent was like the interesting thing about these like backgrounds is that like up until now in this area, 2000, right? 21 years ago. Well, 21 years ago. Like pretty much everything was hand painted, you know, like hand drawn animation. Obviously, like computers and stuff were used to sort of like manage these files, but nothing was really being created like the way that we understand it today. Like so this was they used a lot of of this 3D they called it like tridigital art, I don't know, in their thing, but it's like just the blend of digital art and traditional painting to the point that they're like, we did all these paintings in for these backgrounds, right? These traditional paintings, and we could take them into Photoshop and adjust the lighting or like alter them a little bit so they fit this scene instead. So what needed to be like 1800 individual paintings only now has to be like 600, and we can edit them for like different times of day instead of having to repaint that scene from scratch to make it day or night, you know. It was just, and now like that stuff seems like everybody does that, you know. Everybody does digital paintings. Like, I don't know. Not a lot of shows, I think, these days have like traditional painted backgrounds. I mean, I could be totally be wrong about that. I don't work in cartoons or showbiz or anything yet. I don't know. It's just like the age of technology beginning to dawn. Like, and this is probably like Photoshop, like CS, like 2, 3, and now we're like much farther than that. And it's just whack. But yeah, the art and the backgrounds in this, I think, are super lit. They just do a really good job of creating this sort of atmosphere and this mood, I think. Like, even when, like, Teal and Miguel are having their sort of breakup, like, all the, like, radiance that was in El Dorado is, like, sort of dimmed a little bit. You know, it's a little darker, you're a little more sad. And then, yeah. I just love, like, visual storytelling in that regard. Like, you could tell some shit was going down even if you missed, like, that first scene that explains why they're all upset. Yeah. Which leads me to another tangent. Sorry.
No, do it.
If you have
do
something it. To say,
go for
can we
it.
Talk about miscommunication as a plot device? Like, you should have just talked, you know? Like, instead Miguel was just like grippy Gus, like, for date, like, a long time, when he could have just been like, hey, did you mean that when you said, like, you didn't want me, you know?
Yeah.
And, like, obvious, like, Tulio's language to him, like, throughout this sort of, Miguel feeling, like, neglected, like, he still really cares for him, like, when they were running, like, obviously they were still on the same team when the Jaguar comes out and they have to fight that thing, but, they, like, escape from the lava pits and, like, you know, like, Tulio puts his hand on Miguel's back, like, are you okay? And then when Miguel jumps onto the boat, to, like, you know, help them out, and Tulio's like, you know, like, you can't, like, leave if you go out on the boat. And he's like, yeah, I know. And, like, the smile on Tulio's face, oh my god. They love each other.
Yes.
That's it.
The bromance, or the romance. I saw, what was it? Apparently there's a internet headcanon that they were originally written as a couple, but the world wasn't ready for that in 2000.
Hey.
And so that was another meme format where it's like, oh, this is my boyfriend and his boyfriend.
Bisexual polyamory is where it's at. Anyway. That's interesting that you bring, because, like, this film was apparently supposed to be very, very saucy.
Yes.
And obviously, that's saying something considering how, like, horny this movie still ends up being. Like, you know, the whole scene of Chell and Tulio is, like, from the moment it starts, like, you know, like, Chell is cooking something up. And, you know, gets it. Whatever. But, like, I also was, like, doing some... And, like, apparently Chell was supposed to have, like, even, like, was supposed to have scantily, like... a revealing outfit or something, and they had to change that. And I'm like, okay, how much worse was it because she's already not wearing a lot of, like...
Yeah, so it's like, so this is the toned down version?
Right? I'm like, what were you guys doing, like, back there, right? Like, I really think Chell's a cute character. I really love her design and stuff. But, like, I'm just like, what are you, you know? It's interesting when, you know, people design characters, especially women characters, but that's a whole other thing. But what's interesting about, like, the way they animated Chell, too, is that, so, like, they sort of gave, like, the lead animators free range to sort of develop these characters, right? Which is really cool, instead of, like, this sort of rigid, here's the character, you have to do it exactly like this. Like, obviously, like, I was the background animators, not to discredit them, but, like, they got the you do this part. But the animator for Chell was, like, having conversations with her voice actress, whose name I don't have pulled up, I'm sorry, but like studying her and her mannerisms and her little like twicks and twerks, or quirks, I guess is the word that I was looking for, and like using those to like give Chell just like a they wanted her to be very like likable and real and, you know, cute, so they sort of took what they had. And I think, you know, I really like Chell. I think she's great.
But. And just for the record, the voice actress is Rosie Perez.
Yes, thank you, Rosie Perez, for all that you have done for us.
It's sorry, you know, just kind of no, like looking through animation as a medium is super fascinating too, because I feel like it has arguably it. I mean, I guess it's definitely the visual form in like movies and TV shows that has grown like exponentially since the 90s, because like around that time period we had like this huge spread of things where we had, you know, the introduction of what you said it was like, what was the animation where it was kind of the combination of paintings and hand-drawn and the digital.
It was just the team in DreamWorks called it something. I don't remember. Okay. Oh, Tradigital Hybrids. That's Tradigital. What they decided to call it.
Yeah, because I know you see a lot of those in like animated movies, and you see the beginning of like CGI around this time, which is interesting because early CGI gave us, you know, the whole spread of just bizarre to like actually really, really impressive and still holds up. Like you have... On one side, you have The Rock from The Mummy and Scorpion King, which is, you know, it's...
Could just be worse.
It just kind of seems out of place, whereas, especially, like, looking back now. But then you have, like, Lord of the Rings, which came out around the same time, and it's just, like, that still holds up. Like, Gollum still looks... Like, if they were to make it today, he'd probably look... almost the same, which is incredible. And so it's interesting because you can kind of watch in these animation movies like that progression, and that's one thing that I find super fascinating is to watch that, you know, technological advancement. And, you know, essentially I'd say that's the foreshadowing to Pixar taking over the whole scene, and the way that they solidified that was they managed to find a way to just write stories that just get you no matter what they're doing. They're just like, oh, this is an idea, here's how we make adults cry. We got it, easy, we figured it out. It's the solution. If you can make adults cry genuinely, mm-hmm. you're gonna take over the world or whatever market you're in. Good job, Pixar.
You know, bitches hate crying, but bitches love to cry. It's me and bitches. I'm like, oh, this got me. What's the last movie that made you cry, Patrick?
I think, aside from this one, the last movie that I watched was actually The Motorcycle Diaries.
Interesting.
And that one drew some tears, because that's, you know, so that movie is actually about Che Guevara's diary when he took a motorcycle trip around South America, and that was kind of a lot of what he saw there, like the poverty and you know the consequences and fallout of imperialistic capitalism from the US and Europe in South America. And that was kind of what was planting the seeds and solidifying his future movements. And I highly recommend watching that movie, and I definitely want to read the book because it is actually just an account that he wrote, and it's a collection of like letters and diary entries about that trip that he took. And yeah, that one had me crying.
Yeah, that's some real shit.
A bit of a turn.
Yeah. I was going to say this movie because I like the Elton John song so much, you know? But... Yeah, I mean, whatever gets you.
Yeah, I do love me some Elton John.
Classic Rocket Man.
What a, yes. Oh. And I just, oh. Love me some Tiny Dancer.
Oh,
Yeah, he
call
was
me
just on
closer,
a
Tony
roll.
Danza.
He was on a roll in the early 2000s. He just casually went, crushed it with Lion King.
Oh.
Like, oh, let's mess around and do some other animated movies. And fortunately, this one didn't do so well. But hey, provided music for cult classic.
Oh yeah. I
Do
love
you
that
think
this is
there's.
called a cult classic.
Yes. Do you think there's like a certain, like, couple of elements that are necessary to create a cult classic like this one?
Let's see. I think it has to be a little weird, a little off the beat. Like this movie's funny, right? And there's some funny things about it, which I think makes it a little off the beat. It has to be, obviously it couldn't have like made it at the box office. It had to have like sort of went under the radar, right? In order for like these people to come along and pick it up and for everyone to be like, oh, this shit good. I don't watch a lot of movies to be super familiar with like cult classic stuff, but like I think it has to be a little weird. I think it has to not be super popular, obviously. Like, I mean, I don't, when I talk about Road to El Dorado to somebody who's seen it, they're like, oh yeah, that movie's great. At least in my experience, nobody's told me that they hated it. Maybe they're just being afraid. But
Yeah, I
like,
guess. Yeah, another thing I like in, I guess, incorporate with a cult classic being a cult classic is that, you know, it's got to be like low budget to an extent. And it's kind of more like, I guess you'd call indie film sort of thing. And this one, you're like, I mean, DreamWorks was like coming out, but they, I wouldn't necessarily define them as indie, you know?
They're interestingly indie because I don't know. That's DreamWorks is a big
And I mean, I guess like they're big now.
yeah. But they're still sort of like the underdogs, you
Yes.
know, when it comes to shit like Disney and Pixar, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's
Yeah.
interesting too because like at DreamWorks, maybe even would you? I'm trying to think. I wonder if they would be defined as indie back in 2000s because this was what their third movie, with their first one being Ants and then the second one being Prince of Egypt. Both of which had much more like mature themes, I'm pretty sure. And so that's one thing that I read up on was that they were like, okay, they were trying to find their footing about like who they were as a studio, like what defined them. Whereas Disney kind of was like, oh, we have these, you know, hyper positive kind of movies with borderline realistic expectations and depictions of life sort of thing. But they still touch you and they still mean a lot. Whereas DreamWorks, I feel like, kind of had was like the. Also, with it being born from someone who's very publicly kicked out of Disney, hence the character Farquaad, which is just a completely not. I guess, like, when I was a kid, like. Now saying that, like, Farquaad, like. It's just Fuckwad, just like really poorly, like. Covered, and he's written to basically be the guy who, if I remember right, fired or kicked him out of Disney. Like, just a direct, like, this is you. This is what I think of you.
Okay, so I knew like a bit of the tea about the DreamWorks and the Disney thing, but like connecting those dots is fucking hilarious. No wonder why Farquaad's tower is a fucking like you know, amusement park. That's hilarious. Oh my God. Thank you for opening these doors for me, Patrick. That makes that movie thoroughly more enjoyable.
And so I think that also added a lot to DreamWorks' success is that the goal was to kind of to set out and be similar to Disney but not be Disney.
Yeah.
And I think in doing so in the long run, I mean this is also my pure opinion and
Sure.
speculation, but like I think it also kind of set groundwork for Disney to kind of become a lot more of what it is now, where they do have some more gritty and mature kind of themes that aren't like traumatizing a la Pinocchio kids turning into donkeys or Dumbo's experience with drugs. Both of which I remember like rewatching in high school and being like, what the fuck?
Yeah. Can't say I've rewatched Dumbo in the last 10 years, so
Yeah,
spooky
it's.
stuff.
Yeah, and so I think that, I guess looking at it, I would say that The Road to El Dorado was almost DreamWorks just testing out their comedic chops.
Oh, it totally was.
And so it was just kind of like, not only like testing them out, but just being like, yeah, we fucking got it. And just nailing it. Because on top of that, like, I also read another opinion article that someone was saying, like, you know, DreamWorks, a lot of their movies, like, the internet loves them. Like, Shrek, being the, you know, basically the overlord meme to rule all memes, where it
You mean
just.
the Ogre Lord?
Exactly. But see, so like, Shrek is borderline like synonymous with memes. Whereas the opinion from this article was that The Road to El Dorado is kind of just like this beautiful, perfect, you know, internet baby where it's not overused. It's in the conscience of everybody. Everybody knows what it is. They understand it and they appreciate it, but it's not like oversaturated.
Oh yeah, it's a little niche.
Yes, exactly. But at the same time, it's everybody is, you know, I'd argue is likely in my boat where it's like, I know that. I recognize that. I think I've seen that, but I don't know why. So you have that connection, or you grew up and you remember it clearly and fondly and you love it. So I think it's got that perfect balance where it's kind of just, and I think that's what's made it super successful, and you know, maybe even surge back now with, because it's just full of, like you said earlier, clippable moments, like gifable. It's, you know, it's all these little things, and they're not overused but recognizable. So I think it's just that it hit that perfect balance in the long run. So it is a bummer, maybe, that it flopped in the box office, but.
Yeah. They definitely deserve to make back that money, but you
Yeah.
know, I'll take my cult classic that failed at the box office, you know? I'll take it in a little doggy
Exactly.
bag.
Yes. Every time.
Oh, the characterization in this movie is so good. Like, okay, couple tangents. Cortez. Oh, like he is the bitch in charge, you know? He had like the design to his face, like the low-level eyes, and Jim Cunning's like fucking voice acting, like very on the slate, very much like this is a bitch. And like when they find Tulio Miguel on the ship and he like has his threatening moment and he's like to the brig. Oh my God, it's just like, you know, like,
He only has like three lines too, and
but they're
he just.
all so well delivered that I just lose my mind.
Yeah, like I think we mentioned it earlier, just like the star-studded cast that
Oh
was
yeah.
part of this movie is unbelievable. And
Yeah.
like they delivered. And so it's just, I don't know. Like part of me is still like part of me gets it why it was maybe a flop. Just kind of looking at it from like that critical perspective, the
Yeah,
critic's perspective,
some of the
but
critic
like
reviews I read are a little,
they're a
but
little rough, but at the same time it's like you're, you know, if you like something you like it, you don't always have to. I feel like there's almost like this weird like Oscar-worthy obsession.
Yeah.
And like what we, and to an extent some things are like lost to that where it's just like, oh, this was so good. This was so good, but this was so bad. Again, like what Sara was saying, like this thing good, this thing bad is like it's good to an extent, but at the same time, what matters is, you know, did you connect with the story? Did you enjoy watching it? Like, was it funny? Was it goofy? And I think that all plays into like expectations again. And so, and I think that it's like you were saying, just like Cortez and Cummings, like just nailing that part.
Yeah, and he also did a couple other like I was about to call them NPC voices.
I mean, hey, they fit just the background characters and
The
just the.
background characters, yeah, like the guy who gets stepped on by the jaguar, like the hilarious voice, like great. Jim Cunnings also did the guy who like ran in to warn them about Cortez. Great work. And Zekel Khan's like voice acting too, the way he gets like low and growly and stuff. Oh, it's so like Armand Asante, I can't pronounce it, was nominated for his voice acting in that. He's, according to this resource that I have, he's the only one that was nominated for his voice acting, but he did a fucking good job.
Yes.
So, like the way he can like go from like just the transitions in his voice, like I think about when he goes like to the chief, like, you know, Happy New Year. That's hilarious. But then like when he's ducking into the shadows after Miguel tells him to get out, he's like, as the gods command, you know, like all spooky and like dramatic, like, I don't know. It's just good delivery. I mean, yeah. But all the voice acting, obviously, like I was saying, is like fabulous. But those two in particular really stand out to me just because they're great. But I'm talking about, I want to talk about the introduction to these characters too. Because we're introduced to Tulio and Miguel, like, gambling, doing their thing, like, being con men, using their loaded dice, and, like, using their shticks to get out of a tight situation. And we meet, Chief Tenenbach, that's it, right? The chief.
Chief Tani.
We meet Chief Tani, like, in this beautiful room, playing with kids, you know, like, being, like, a good guy. And then shift to meeting Zekel Khan, like, in a spooky temple with weird magic going on. It's very dark. It's like, I wonder who the antagonist is, you know? Even to that detail, like obviously, like, he's wearing red all over the place. He's in the spooky temple, like, intact. But, like, the way they animate the eyes, there's, like, they don't use, like, a white reflection, really. They use, like, a colored reflection, which I think is really interesting. And they use red for Zekel Khan. And I just, it's so good.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. Because they also, in the critics' critiques was, reviews. What they said was, one common thing was that they're saying that, like, the characters were flat and they lacked depth, and the story was predictable. But, like, what I think is good about, like, what you're saying about the character introductions, like, in a story like this, that's the way you do it. You just, like, and that's also part of foreshadowing and stuff. And you have to remember, this is a comedy first. Did you laugh watching the movie? I hope so. If you did, then good. The comedy did its part. Like, that was the point.
Yeah.
And I think, again, like, I think, you know, from that movie critics, like, lens, that can be kind of rough because all films are created with different intentions and they're looking for different reactions, so you just gotta, you know, I feel like some people look at every movie as if it's like some, you know, grand Oscar dive, and it's like, not everyone's making these movies to get an Oscar.
Yes, sometimes you just want to make something.
Yeah, sometimes you want to make something that's funny, sometimes you want to make something that's serious.
I don't know, it's like the whole, like, predictable plot, like, flat character, like, I don't know, I'm, like, watching this again, it's, like, I know how to get out of it, because I've watched it, like, plenty of times, but it's, like, watching it for that first time, it's, like, how are they gonna get out of it? Like, even with their interactions with Zekel Khan, like, he was kind of on their side for a hot minute, you know? He trusted them until, like, you know, he, like, learned.
Yeah.
Obviously, Chell and Tani, like, and Chief saw through that kind of immediately, and you get this great line, when Miguel's having his moment, like, on the boat, like, we need more rope, this can't do, you know, we need to stay, and, like, whatever, and...
Oh, that one touched my heart.
Oh,
I know
so
exactly
good.
Where you're going with it. It's like, when he just, you know, just kind of offers back to heirs to human.
Yeah, and he kind of just, like, leans back, and he might as well have winked, but, like, he fucking gets it, but, like, we spent that time with Miguel in the city, you know, to really understand, like, he's a good fucking guy, and I wanted to talk about that, too, because it's not just, like, oh, he doesn't want people to be sacrificed, you know, that's not really what shows him to be a good guy, but, like, I think the part that really stands out to me is when he, after he, like, saved that guy from the guards, and then he puts together his, like, loot or whatever.
Yes.
Like some sort of string instrument. And he's like jamming on it, and these kids come by and they're like scared. So he plays like a more gentle tune. And I'm like, I don't know, that whenever people like have that sort of like good with kids, you know, mm-hmm. love that. And then that song leads into the song of the scene, and then it's just great.
Yeah, I love that too, because looking at both at like Miguel and Tulio, like I also think that's such a good one, especially like when they're coming in the boat and they're just kind of talking about their regrets and then them just like opening up and being like, you made my life an adventure. You made my life rich. And yes. It's like, A, you're just spelling out their, you know, motivations and just kind of, their characters could be viewed as flat, but like, I like that. Like, it's just kind of, it's still touching. It's, you know, some things don't need to be super complicated and complex. Like, mm-hmm. that's fine.
And I think, I don't know. The flat character thing still gets, because I just think about like the way they animate, the way that they look at each other, or the way they mm-hmm. don't look at each other specifically, especially in that Friends Never Say Goodbye yes. scene. Like how can you, like, they obviously are like have so much emotion going on that like to call these like flat like 2D characters, like, okay, I guess you have happy and sad, but like
yeah.
you can feel the turmoil, and it just
yes. And also like again, that's like, I think it's just people trying to draw the biggest expectations to get, honestly, like a lot of those reviews even feel like clickbaitish, because it's just like, oh, I wanted this. And they all gravitate towards one thing. So I'm, you know, assuming one person watched it and said that thing and then like, oh, yeah, that's right. La, 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 but then this. And it's like, I enjoyed this movie. Like, I really like this movie. I love this movie. And I think it's, you know, with time, it's added with my current lens of, you know, D&D player, fan. Mm-hmm. I think that adds a whole new lens that I really love watching it through. It's just kind of, like, when they mention predictable plot, it adds a layer of, like, comedy to me and a layer of experience just imagining it as a D&D game.
Yeah.
And a campaign and just watching them be like, oh, you know, two people, like, or, like, three or four people, however many are involved in that game, just, like, actively creating this story and then just letting the fate of the dice, like, determine what happens next. Like, that's how it plays out.
Yeah.
And I enjoy that. I really enjoy approaching stories that way to an extent.
Yeah, and you gotta, like, it's a fucking adventure, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's what D&D is. That's what this particular movie is like, literally, like, going on that sense of adventure, what Miguel always wanted, you know? And taking Tulio with him, and Altivo, and Chell, and the rest of the, mm-hmm. you know? And it's like, okay, predictable plot, going from point A to point B, but all the zigzagging and spinning around and all this shit that goes on between there is what makes it interesting, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah. Not every story or plot needs a twist.
Nah. Sometimes I hate twists. I'm like, oh, come on. And then I put down the story and I never read it again. I've done that to books. I'm like, I don't care. Yeah. It sort of takes the pressure off this movie from being, like, more egregious than it needs to be. You know? Like, this is a fun movie. Like, to have it to be very complicated and dark and have all these plot twists and whatever. I don't know. I just, like, okay, you can have it. I don't know.
I like it how
it is. Yeah, I like it how it is. I agree. You know? It's a good film. Everybody, yeah. Watch The Road to El Dorado. DreamWorks film came out in 2000. Yes.
People went out and they created it, and they clearly had fun doing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, like, that's super apparent from literally, like, we were starting off talking, like, the voice actors for Miguel and Tulio. Like, you can hear how much fun they had mm-hmm. making this. And that's what matters. Like, they enjoyed creating it. And I'd like to imagine that Jim Cummings, like, enjoyed making it, since he just walked on and just delivered those lines.
Fucking killed it, yeah.
Fucking killed it. And same thing with Asante, I believe.
Yeah. And it's, you can just like sort of feel the like passion for the project come through, which I think is just awesome. At least, I mean, maybe some people, you know, did not like working on this movie. But hey, everybody who did, I feel ya. And I appreciate all of your hard work. If you're out there, if you're listening to this podcast, thank you.
If you somehow stumbled on this podcast,
thanks Elton for John, that, thank man. You for... Hans Zimmer, glad you're tuning in, you know?
Yes.
Join us, be our next guest.
Yes, that would be incredible. Oh.
I'm just thinking about that. Anyway. Well, Patty, did you ever think it would end like this?
Well, the horse was a surprise. Spent the last year trying to mend the way you left me lying wide-eyed in my bed.
Patrick, you were talking about Cortez earlier and how like his character sort of gets across that this is a mean bitch, and like I just want to talk about how much I think like the character is like... I love that you're texting me right now.
I pulled up one of my tabs and I was like, oh, I think you'd want to see this because I talked about it earlier. So
okay, yeah, I would definitely love to.
Here we are. But, welcome to the Meta Podcast.
The Meta Podcast. We talk about our podcast that we're podcasting later. Anyway.